KQED.
This is the California Report. Good morning. I'm John Sepulveda. We begin in Riverside County, where two parents have been arrested on charges of torture and child endangerment. David and Louise Turpin are alleged to have imprisoned their 13 children in their suburban Paris home. That's a community about an hour north of San Diego. Investigators say the children, some as old as 29 years old, are emaciated to the point that they look like young kids. They were allegedly shackled to their beds, and the rooms were found with what is believed to be human waste in them. Mark Ufer is the CEO of the Corona Regional Medical Center. He told NBC News that the responding staff at the hospital could not believe some of the captives were adults.
It's actually heartbreaking for the staff, and it's unbelievable what you see.
Both parents are being held in jail. David Turpin is an engineer who worked at Northrop Grumman. His wife ran a homeschool out of their home in Paris. We're going to go now to Santa Barbara County, where officials say it will be at least another week until the 101 opens up after a deadly mudslide that killed at least 20. In the meantime, people are relying on some good old-fashioned transportation alternatives, as KQED's Stephen Cuevas tells us.
It usually takes Mitchell Guzman about 40 minutes to drive from Ventura to his job in Montecito. But today, with the area's main commuter lifeline, the 101 freeway, and other major roads damaged and swamped with muck, it'll take about 2 hours by boat.
About an hour and a half sailing time up to Santa Barbara.
A pair of whale watching companies are running emergency commuter ferries between the Ventura and Santa Barbara harbors for workers, first responders, and medical personnel like Guzman, at a cost of $32 per trip.
I didn't go to work at all last week, and I plan to stay there this week.
It's his first day back at work as a full-time in-home caregiver. His wife, also a caregiver, has been looking after their elderly client in Montecito since the storm and landslide struck. She'll rotate out when Guzman arrives.
Well, when I get there, she's going to come back.
This is my first day since the floods to go to Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Because we can't get through.
On the upper deck of the ferry, Bill Pintard is passing the time talking to an old friend about all the news, about friends and acquaintances who perished in the storm or lost homes. Pintard lives on the eastern edge of Montecito. He's headed to Santa Barbara for some business meetings, then to see a friend laid up in the hospital.
And he got washed down to Highway 101 in San Ysidro, and he broke his back. His father didn't survive. He survived. This whole thing is really sobering, and it's really hit every one of us to our very gut, to our very heart, and our soul.
The temporary commuter ferries aren't as packed as they were last week now that Amtrak's back in service. Amtrak is running extra trains along the Santa Barbara-Ventura coast. A passenger named Michelle has been taking the ferry to work in Santa Barbara each morning. She takes the train back home to the northern side of Ventura, where the Thomas Fire ignited last month.
For me, the fire was an issue for weeks. And then now here's a mudslide, and I've been taking the boat, you know, to get to work.
Caltrans and the Army Corps of Engineers continue to clear a miles-long stretch of the 101 freeway of mud, boulders, tree limbs, and other debris. Officials hope to have the freeway reopened sometime next week. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Santa Barbara.
A Ventura County family is appealing to the California Department of Education to take action after they say a teacher used anti-Islamic material in his curriculum at the local school district. Here's more from KQED's Vanessa Roncagno.
A few months ago, Asfar Kadus's 12-year-old son came home with a handout from his teacher.
And I looked at the sheet, and it had, like, really horrible things written on it.
Some of the information the teacher used in the social studies class mirrors information found on the website billionbibles.org. The site promotes a radical view of Christianity and says Satan uses Muslims to kill Christians, and that people should be afraid of Islam. The students got material that purported to interpret Islamic law and the Holy Quran.
I told my son, this is not what Islam is, and what this sheet is saying has nothing to do with our religion. And that's what made him really sad. He's like, well, no, that's not what my friends think.
Islamic studies professors say the list the teacher gave students relies on strict interpretations of Quranic verses, interpretations that are unrecognizable to modern Muslims. The Center for American Islamic Relations helped the Qudus family file a complaint with the Mesa Union School District, arguing the teachers' actions violate state and federal anti-discrimination laws and violate the constitutional separation of church and state. Attorney Patricia Schnell worked with the family.
There's nothing that could be done with these materials in a public school that would not violate the First Amendment.
The district superintendent declined to be recorded, but in a statement said the district takes all complaints seriously and responds swiftly. He added that the district continues to seek a resolution of this matter.
This could kind of forever shape this community's vision of who Muslims are and what Islam is.
The Qudus family filed a complaint with the California Department of Education last week. They want an apology and consequences for the teacher. And they want students to get a fair education about Islam. The latest survey results from the California chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations shows bullying and discrimination from teachers, administrators, and other officials against Muslim students went up 18% from 2014 to 2016. For the California Report, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
The Me Too movement and more recent Time's Up Now campaign have shown a light on the sexual harassment of women in the arts, politics, and journalism. Immigrant working class women spoke up about sexual harassment before Me Too broke. In 2015, Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine, produced a project called Rape on the Night Shift about janitors who experience sexual harassment and assault while cleaning office buildings, often from their supervisors. She shared an update to that story with KQED's Stephen Cuevas.
I mean, after hearing the stories that were in the radio documentaries and the frontline films, women started taking action themselves. They basically organized themselves into groups of promotoras, women who go out to the buildings to educate other women. They held a hunger strike in Sacramento to get a law passed to improve protections for janitors. And they've even started doing self-defense classes, learning how to protect themselves on the job.
What do the janitors you've talked to say about the Me Too movement?
Well, you know, I had a chance to visit one of these self-defense classes that janitors have organized in Los Angeles. And I checked back in with Georgina Hernandez. She's one of the janitors that we've been following over the last few years. When we first talked with her, she was so timid and shy and reluctant to even tell her story. And now here she was leading this self-defense class and saying that, you know, when she sees these women from the Me Too movement.
A la vez me da tristeza y coraje porque digo yo, ellas tienen dinero.
It makes her sad and angry at the same time. I mean, these women in Hollywood have money, they're powerful, they have everything in life that she doesn't have. So on the one hand, she's proud of them for speaking up, but when she spoke up, she asks, who listened to me? Nobody. These women are women who are worth something, but she says, I'm a woman who's worth something too.
Yo soy mujer de valor también.
That's a sentiment that we heard from a lot of women. And even with this new effort called the Time's Up campaign to kind of bring working class women into the Me Too movement, I think there's still real questions about the barriers to these women speaking up. I mean, they are fearful of losing their jobs, their ability to support their families, and in some cases, fearful of being deported.
Since this reporting went national, have there been changes in the workplace? Has the janitorial industry taken any actions to prevent women from being harassed and assaulted in the workplace?
Well, in large part because of the organizing of the janitors themselves, we have a new law here in California, inspired by our reporting, that actually takes effect this year. And basically what it does is it requires janitorial companies to register with the state in the first place. I mean, a lot of these companies are subcontractors, kind of fly-by-night operations. So this is a way to keep track of them. It also requires mandatory training for all employees, both janitors and their supervisors, on sexual harassment. And here in California, the Janitors Union has actually been able to get language around sexual harassment into their contracts. So there has been some change within the companies in terms of laws that they have to follow, and I think more of a recognition that they really have to take this issue seriously.
That's host of the California Report magazine, Sasha Coca. She reported Rape on the Night Shift as part of a collaboration with our partners at Reveal, the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley, Univision, and Frontline. The updated Frontline film airs tonight on PBS, and we'll hear more about the Janitors Project on the California Report magazine later this week. The new year started on a disappointing note for one group, abalone divers. Normally in the springtime, they take to the waters north of San Francisco Bay to harvest the mollusks. But the iconic red abalone is in such serious trouble that state fish and wildlife officials voted to close the North Coast sport fishery for the first time ever. Sherry Quinn spent a day with a scientist at the beach during one of the last times divers could harvest the prized abalone.
A remote beach a few hours north of San Francisco bustles with dozens of abalone divers boasting about their catches. But Dr. Cynthia Catton, an environmental scientist with the California Fish and Wildlife Service, sees something else when she analyzes the abalone as they emerge from the water. Signs of starvation.
We're seeing dying abalone that have just fallen off the rock.
Catton and her team of volunteers turn the reddish shells upside down, exposing the mollusks' mushy bodies. She calls out their measurements of their glistening dark gray foot muscles, the succulent edible meat. The higher the number between 0 and 4, the more likely they are to be starving to death.
I would probably call that at least a 2, but it's close to 3.
Catton has looked at 6,000 abalone over the past few years, and more than 25% showed signs of starvation. Underwater surveys reveal even grimmer results.
In areas where we would normally see abalone all over the reef, we're seeing piles and piles of shells.
Those results led to a decision to close the North Coast to red abalone sport fishing in 2018. The mollusks are so scarce that divers have been risking their lives to collect them in deeper, more dangerous waters. Since 2015, more than a dozen divers have died trying.
The collapse of this fishery is devastating, especially for these small communities on the North Coast that really rely on tourism that these fisheries bring in.
Overfishing is an issue, but climate change is the main culprit. Warming ocean water has weakened the abalone's food source, kelp, and so there isn't enough seaweed to go around. As a result, the abalone are malnourished and dying off in alarming numbers. The North Coast now joins Southern California, where all abalone harvesting has been banned since 1998. For the California Report, I'm Sherry Quinn in Point Arena.
Support for the California Report comes from the Barracuda Networks. Network, application, content and data security solutions for physical networks and public cloud platforms. Learn more at barracuda.com/products. The California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems.
That's the California Report for Tuesday, January 16th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm John Sepulveda. Have a great day.